Good morning. Welcome to Talking About California, a series of discussions with Californians who talk about this state, their home here, and their work. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning's guest is Professor Robert Brenner. Robert Brenner has been a professor of history at UCLA since 1968. He's director of the Center for Social Theory and Comparative History, an interdisciplinary center at UCLA. Professor Brenner is perhaps best known for his work in two areas. First, in early modern English history, he's the Brenner of the Brenner debate, a debate among historians about the transition from feudalism to capitalism. I might add here that there's no shortage of name debates amongst historians, but few refer not to the subject of the debate, but to a single participant. Hence, we have the Brenner debate and a 1985 book, The Brenner Debate, Agrarian Class Structure and Economic Development in Pre-Industrial Europe. And he's also the author of Merchants and Revolution, 1993, An Interpretation of the English Revolution. His most recent work, and I think we'll turn to this morning, involves investigations in the post-war world economy. And three important books here need to be mentioned: The Boom and the Bubble, The U.S. and the World Economy, 2002, The Economics of Global Turbulence, 2006, and What's Good for Goldman Sachs is Good for America, 2009. Finally, Bob's the editor with his son Aaron and yours truly of Rebel Rank and File, Verso Book 2010, and he's also on the editorial boards of Against the Current and the New Left Review. Good morning, Professor Brenner, and I'll call you Bob if that's okay.
I hope so, Cal.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Great. Well, why don't we just begin with this second area of your work that I mentioned, and maybe you could tell us a bit about becoming an economist, because you started off really as an historian.
Sure. I mean, I think you need to, and your listeners need to hear the word economist with big scare quotes there. I mean, I'm not a professionally trained economist, but even if I were, I would probably not have learned how to do the things I ended up trying to do, since most contemporary economics stays far away from those kind of historical questions and questions about non-functioning and functioning of capitalism. In any case, I got involved in work on the economy, so to speak, out of kind of the activity, political activity I was involved in, like many others. In the late 60s, early 70s, I was, again, like many of my contemporaries, involved in the SDS, Students for Democratic Society, sort of big mass student movement of the mid-late 60s, which was particularly involved in the war, you know, fighting the war in Vietnam. At the end of this period, sort of around 1970, the late 60s, early 70s, SDS entered into a crisis, and we were kind of a little bit bereft, many of us, since this was an organization and activities we had very much identified with. But at the same time, we were looking to become more effective. And again, like many in my generation of leftists, we sought to make a turn or transition or get involved with working people and working class organizing. In my case, I had sort of had an idea that this was the right thing to do for a long time. I came out of a left-wing family, red diaper baby and all that, but I didn't really know much about it and less about the theory. But suddenly we had been involved. There was a big, as people may remember or at least have read about, I mean, there was huge mass movements on the campus that resulted from the American incursion into Cambodia in 1970. Campuses were shut down. UCLA was shut down. And at that time, Teamsters, rank and file Teamsters, who were involved in a national wildcat strike, came on campus looking for support for their strike. And I was involved with a number of others in bringing students en masse down to the picket lines to try to help them man the picket lines since they had an injunction against them. I mention all this detail because essentially what happened as a result of this, in this case, but I think numbers of other people in my generation, as we were looking for ways to essentially reach beyond the campus and reach and begin to organize, so to speak, everyday people, everyday working people in the society. And many of us became involved in local groups or national groups that were doing this. So suddenly, became involved in a local LA group that we organized, so-called collective, and we're trying to understand the situation. Suddenly, you know, we begin to think of ourselves as Marxists, whatever that was. It was something else that, like, oriented the working class. I had thought, but I had really not very much idea about it. So at that time, trying to understand what was going on in the economy, which is a way to understand what was going on, essentially one way of beginning to understand what was going on with U.S. workers, started to look at what was happening with the American economy, the world economy. And at that very moment, there was the beginning, and many of us recognized it, but not just us, people in the mainstream of political economists saw that there were beginning to be problems in the U.S. economy. Indeed, there were problems of profitability that had developed from the late 60s into the mid-70s. So this is essentially where I began, trying to figure out, like others, other colleagues and friends, so what's going on in the world economy that's affecting the working people we're involved with. At that time, there were many unionized workers, unlike today, that we were involved with. So what can we expect to happen, and what is happening now? We lacked one thing, which was education in economics and in Marxist political economy and all of this. So, in effect, the way I started to learn it, again, many others, I know Cal had Mike Davis on the show a while back. People like Mike and myself at UCLA began to teach essentially classes and hold study groups on capital and other aspects of political economy, whatever the people who were writing at the time, people like Ernest Mandel on the one hand, the Monthly Review people on the other, and of course Marx himself and Capital. We taught this stuff, and over a number of years, by teaching it, we kind of learned it and developed an approach to it. So essentially, that's a long way around, though, but of saying why, effectively, I became involved with learning about political economy, learning about Marxist economics, and the kind of context, practical context, which I think has been very important for, you know, all the rest.
So my memory, Bob, is that trying to develop an analysis of the post-war World War II years in the States was pretty important in those days in trying to work out what was happening. Is that part of the story?
Absolutely. So, I mean, as I just said, just at this time, probably no accident in retrospect at the time, we probably didn't see it as clearly as we might have, although we thought we were seeing something changing in a very big way, which was that we had grown up, all of us, in this great post-war boom where, in effect, the U.S. economy and, indeed, the European, Japanese economies experienced the greatest period of economic expansion in history for 2 to 3 decades. Hugely, you know, rapid economic growth, standards of living were increasing, even economic equality was increasing, wages were growing, the welfare state was able to grow in relationship to it because the surpluses were significant enough to allow social spending to grow significantly. So we had grown up in the context of the boom. And indeed, a number of theories had developed as if the boom was going to be permanent. And much of the new left was about essentially the problems of a capitalism that was had solved its problems of growth and crisis, but quickly became evident that this had not been the case, and that over the period roughly from the late 60s into the early mid-70s, which is exactly this period when around the world radical movements which had begun on campus and outside the working class moved toward the working class, and in relationship to the developing problems of the economy, you had conflicts, deep class conflicts across the world, especially in Europe, places like Italy, France, 68, Italy, late 60s, long hot summers. In France and England, you had a great deal of industrial conflict. And U.S. had the same thing, not as intense, but a similar development. So you got the onset of what turned out to be a very serious economic problems. At that point, one saw there was a beginning of a fall in profitability, and what was happening? What was the source of this? Well, none of us, I think, would really have realized, but over the next period, you get parallel to the long period of boom, a equally long period of downturn, of weakening economic growth and weakening of the economy as a whole, which I would call the long downturn. And essentially, a lot of my work has been about trying to understand why you had a long boom, why you've had this downturn, which is entailed slower GDP growth, less investment, rising, slower growth of employment, rising unemployment, slowdown and complete stagnation of wages. How do you explain this? And essentially what I've tried to do is look at this problem of persistent weakening of the economy, which only led to great crisis in the last, 5 or 6 years. There was a weak economy, but not the kind of crisis that we had seen, say, in the Great Depression. But up till then, ever weakening. So how do you understand this?
Could I just, Bob, interrupt you here?
Please
do. Just one question that's always, you can imagine, kind of made me wonder. In the middle of this, though, in the late 60s and through the 70s, there were a series of sharp short-term downturns, which led many people to think that maybe the system was on its last leg. Could you just put that into the story for us and then come back to the long downturn, because that's what we want to hear.
You're speaking exactly to the story. Essentially what, is exactly on target. What was going on was that you got an intensification. I mean, the problem was that you got an intensification of international competition, starting out especially with Germany, then Japan. And what you got was rapid entry and challenge of these manufacturing economies, the U.S. on the world market, in a kind of uncoordinated, anarchic way, leads to essentially too much manufacturing production in one after another line, and that oversupply puts downward pressure on prices in relationship to the costs of production, which aren't changing, and you have the first push downward on the rate of profit. Now, usually what happens in relationship to such beginning of a crisis, and problem of profitability is that the firms involved make cuts to their investments because they're making smaller surpluses, so they have less to invest. And then at the same time, they attack wages to cut costs. They get the state to reduce social spending to further cut costs. They reduce employment. So you have, in response to fall in profitability as a result of what you might call overaccumulation, too much production in relationship to the cost that you have because the price is falling due to that over capacity or overproduction, you have this fall in profitability, and the cuts that are made both to investment and to wages and social spending lead to a big fall in demand, and then what you have is a shakeout of the over-invested production. The weaker firms fall out, and the stronger ones survive, and you get a new period of expansion. But that did not happen, in the 70s, 80s, and we have to ask. So what you have is that this overcapacity developing in the early 70s, mid-70s, as a result of Japanese and German and the U.S. Producers not dropping out, staying to fight, to fight for the markets. And so, again, you would expect there to be a serious downturn and shakeout. And in fact, you start to get that in 1974 and 5, which you might be referring to, Cal, when you talk about the crises that are hitting. And again, you had a similar one in late 70s and early 80s, very sharp recessions. But why do you get, instead of a kind of depression or deep recession that we've experienced today, and then the shakeout and an opening of a new period of growth, rather we get a continuing, not crisis, but stagnation. Why? Because, as we know, unlike in previous periods, in response to the problem of demand, the problem of demand that resulted from the response to falling profitability, that is, problem of people getting lower wages, people getting lower growth of employment, going more slowly, cutbacks in social spending, all of these are equivalent to a decline in the demand in the economy, which would normally disrupt the economy. But as we know, the cuts in spending, which normally would have led to problems of demand, which would normally have led to recession, maybe deep recession and kind of shakeout that we got in the 1930s, no, instead of having that, we get state intervention. And this state intervention is the key to the long downturn in a way, because it provides an answer, a partial answer, in demand to speak to that lack of demand that was a result of the problems of the economy. In the first instance, as we know, the form of demand was Keynesian budget deficits. So the state borrowed money to be able to spend more, to have the demand, to be able to keep the firms that might otherwise have gone out of business, keep them in business via state demand. At the same time, interest rates were lowered, and there was a good deal of private borrowing made possible by the state borrowing. So what you have, and this is going to be the pattern for the whole subsequent period, is the growth of debt made possible by the state allows for the economy to keep, essentially stumbling along. It allows for more higher prices because there's greater demand in relationship to supply, therefore allows firms that normally could not have stayed in business to stay in business. They stay in business, they keep employment and investment up to a certain degree. And so the growth of debt provides the demand to keep the economy turning over. So that's the positive side.
This is KZYX this morning. Our program is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. This morning we're talking to Professor Robert Brenner from the History Department at UCLA. And we're talking about his work investigating the post-World War II economy. You mentioned the state. Now, do Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan fit into this story?
Yes, exactly. They do very well. But hold it one second. So,
yeah, sure.
In effect, well, you can let's go directly to Reagan. So if you could say that the first response to the fall in profitability, fall in the rate of profit, meaning how much surplus you can get for any given investment, if you get a fall in profitability that results from overcapacity, and then the effects of that are held off by the growth of borrowing by the state, Keynesian deficits, that is what you get in the first instance in the 1970s, and this is what you'd expect, supposedly, from the Democratic administrations that were in charge in that period, in particular, of course, the Carter administration, but you'd also got it in the last Republican administrations of Nixon and Ford. So the 70s is a period of Keynesianism. Now, what it is also, of course, and this is crucial, people don't always take this side into account, it's also the first period of austerity, that is, the attack on working class wages, social spending, is taking place at the same time, and again, there's a fall in investment that's taking place at the same time. So you're getting really the phenomenon of the negative phenomenon that you'd expect as a result of falling profitability answered by the rise in demand made possible by Keynesianism. Now, Ronald Reagan comes in, and he's the great, supposedly great right winger who's going to say that we need to, you know, cut down the state. We need to, you know, balance the budget, cut spending, and this was the platform on which he ran. But as we know, when he actually got into office, and when his Federal Reserve Chair, who's also Carter's Federal Reserve Chair, Paul Volcker, had raised interest rates very, very sharply in order to shake out that great ledge of overcapacity and create the conditions for new boom, this led to an even deeper recession, 1981-82, the worst of the post-war period, and Reagan, frankly, couldn't accept the political consequences of this. A couple years, maybe, but we have to restore order if we're going to get reelected. So what happens in the rest of the 80s is what paradoxically is a new period, the greatest period of Keynesianism that the world has ever seen, overseen by the radical Republican right-winger Ronald Reagan, who does what? On the one hand, sees to big cuts in taxation, almost all solely for the rich, so on the one hand, tax cuts, but on the other hand, massive increases in spending. Spending on what? On the military. So you have a new period of the biggest Keynesian experiment of all, paradoxically, under Reagan. So it's, again, this essentially subsidizing, increasing of demand that keeps the economy turning over. Why is that necessary? Because on the one hand, instead of getting the shakeout of high-cost, low-profit firms alone, you're getting a continual incursion of new manufacturing powers coming from East Asia. First, the East Asian NICs, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and then the so-called little tigers of Southeast Asia, Thailand, Indonesia, etc., and then finally the great behemoth of China. So on the one hand, you're getting a huge, in spite of the problem of overcapacity, you're getting a continual increase in manufacturing production, which is putting downward pressure on prices. At the same time, you're getting even stronger attacks on working people in the sense of wages, social spending, employment, so that you have too much supply, not enough demand, and therefore you're going to really have that great crisis that might have been worried about by Reagan and what looked like to be happening in the early 80s. But no, you have the subsidy to demand provided by the government, by military Keynesianism, by tax cuts to the rich, spending by the on the military, and therefore the state borrowing greatest amounts ever to provide the demand to have the economy continue to turn over. I hope the logic here is clear, because it's a continuing logic. On the one hand, ever more entry of lower cost producers from particularly initially from Germany, Western Europe, but then one after another power in East Asia, putting ever greater pressure on supply, overcapacity. On the other hand, in response to that, firms and governments cutting back, so smaller investment, smaller welfare state, lower wages, slower growth of employment, and therefore big reductions in demand. At the same time, supply is rising. So again, pressure for crisis, but countered again and again. This is the theme of this whole long period, ever greater debt to keep the economy turning over.
We also see what appears, looking back on it, to have been a rather sharp reduction of the American manufacturing base. Is a result of what you're talking about?
Yeah. Absolutely. So let me do two things just to complete this. I'll complete the kind of narrative, and then I'll come back to the question you're asking of what is the long-term effects of, you know, this development on the nature of U.S. political economy, politics, economics, compared to, say, in Asia or in Europe.
Okay.
But just to say that by the early 90s, you had this pattern, as I said, in which government support of debt is providing the key to preventing the economy from going into crisis. But at the same time, the demand the government is providing is not just stabilizing the economy, which it is. It's providing demand to keep lots of firms that otherwise would have gone out of business staying in business, but at the same time, flip side of the same point, by keeping those firms in business, it's keeping in business a lot of high-cost, low-profit, backward firms who can't employ and invest to the same extent as before. So you have no crisis, but stagnation. Essentially, the system, by way of debt, is trading off growth for stability, and that's kind of the Keynesian idea. In the early 90s, the Clinton administration tried to get, and others in Western Europe tried to get beyond this. They said, oh, what we need to do, the state is too big, this is the beginnings of really intense neoliberal policy. The state's too big, too much debt. The state is preventing the private economy from, you know, growing and flourishing. So people may remember there's a big attempt to balance the budget in the early 1990s and to take away the government debt creation that's keeping the system stable, but stagnant. So what happens when that occurs, though, is the world economy in the U.S. goes into the worst recession of the post-war period. How do they get out of it? Basically, they get out of it by taking a new form of developing demand, and this is a much more dangerous, destabilizing method. And that method is for the Federal Reserve to essentially keep interest rates low, to allow asset prices in one way or another to rise. People borrow money, and they invest in markets. And the markets increase in asset prices allows people to borrow and provide the demand that the state had provided directly before. So, for example, in the later 1990s, mid to late 1990s, what is going on? Federal Reserve is making sure that the stock market keeps growing by making money very cheap, making credit very cheap. Firms essentially see their stocks rising, or new firms like the high-tech firms now issue stocks raise money. And what you have is a huge speculative boom in which stock prices reach the highest point since the 1920s. What this allows to happen is for firms to use that apparent increase in their value resulting from the high stock prices. It says, okay, this tech firm is worth zillions, and that they borrow and they invest. And what happens in the late 90s is you have the continuation of the post-war, of this long downturn, the expansion, by virtue of the stock market boom, which allows firms to borrow and which makes for the greatest boom of investment since the post-war boom. And so you have this investment boom that's keeping the economy going. But, of course, the investment boom isn't based on profits. It's based on stock market speculation. Stock market busts, and the economy goes deep into recession, what people thought was going to be a great recession. But then there's a next bubble, which people are very familiar with. The Fed keeps stock interest rates low. And what happens, in a nutshell, we can go on at much greater length, is that people are able to borrow money to buy houses. House prices rise. People have ever more apparent, actually fictitious, wealth in the form of their houses, and that on that basis, they're able to borrow money and consume. And so what you have in relationship to the housing market, the Fed's easy credit has allowed housing prices to skyrocket, allow housing owners who really are not doing very well themselves in terms of employment or in wages, but they have now very valuable houses they borrow against and spend. And so just as in the stock market boom of the 1990s, the stock market bubble allowed for an investment boom while the stocks were high, so does the housing bubble allow for the stock for there to be huge amount of consumer demand that drives the economy until 2007-08, when, in effect, people who really had no basis for being able to borrow except for their bubble-driven housing prices, and they cease to be able to effectively borrow and spend after a certain point, and the housing prices fall, and the housing bubble breaks, and the last prop to demand disappears, and we go into the Great Recession. So what is this to say is that the booms of the late 90s and 2007 were really artificial, depending on this time on bubbles that were effectively nurtured by the Federal Reserve to allow first investment boom, but collapsing with the bubble, then a housing boom collapsing with the housing bubble. And that's essentially where we are, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But you asked, so what is the effect? What has been going on? What's the effect of all of this on people in the United States, the nature of the economy? Because we've been talking about a situation in which what is ultimately fueling growth, but also fueling economic problems, are the entry of one after another of lower-priced manufacturing producers, mostly based in Asia. And what they're doing is essentially using already existing techniques and combining them with lower wages, but also receiving a lot of state support in terms of educated labor force, investment in infrastructure, and support to some degree for technological innovation. So you're getting the counterparts of a manufacturing boom in the economy. Naturally, it was like the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries. You got big growth of infrastructure, big growth of education to supplement the manufacturing expansions. So in these places, you have for the first time, in parts of the so-called third world, integral capitalist manufacturing growth. But this has certain fundamental weaknesses, which we've just alluded to. On the one hand, that growth is taking place at the expense of the already existing manufacturing producers, above all, in the United States. It's taking place because the same things are being produced as before, only more cheaply. So putting pressure on already existing producers. To some extent, those already existing producers survive by becoming technologically more efficient. They're opening up of new lines of production, higher tech lines. But to a great extent, the United States in this process has ever less manufacturing production. And indeed, the dominant forces in the American economy, multinational corporations and financiers, are essentially replacing the big manufacturers that previously dominated.
This is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. Our guest is Professor Robert Brenner from UCLA, professor of history and the director of the Center for Social Theory and Comparative History. And we've been talking about the long-term development of the economy since really World War II up until what's pretty much happening now. So
today, yeah, I was just saying, you had said, well, what is the implication? It's kind of a very intelligent leading question. Well, if you have an overcapacity in manufacturing on a world scale, and meaning particularly intensified price and product competition, particularly in the U.S. being hit by this because they have, essentially they're producing with higher wages, higher rents, et cetera, so that one expected result could be if the U.S. state doesn't move in and try to provide some kind of support for the competitiveness of American industry, which it by and large did not, with a few exceptions, what you end up is a situation in which the strength of the sections, if you will, of the capitalist class that are effectively in control in the United States are ever more manufacturing industrial producers who are able to produce on a world scale, multinational producers, and who have probably more than half of their output and plant and equipment and labor overseas, and then financiers who initially financed that internationalization or globalization of American capital, but then also become involved in the U.S. and on a world scale in banking and speculation. And the bubble economies that I was just talking about. But the upshot is that we face a very paradoxical situation that must have impressed many of your listeners, which is this: how can it be that the United States government, both parties, are allowing to such a great extent the disintegration of American education, attack on the schools? How can they allow to such an extent the decline in infrastructures, roads, bridges, not to mention labs and technology, et cetera? How can they allow this to go on? Aren't they paying attention to the needs of American capital? Well, the fact is they are paying attention to the needs of American capital, which needs, at this point, a much more boiled down, a much more restricted system of education focused on the elites. I mean, elite education is alive and well in this country in the better-off sections of cities and in private schools and in great private universities and to increasing extent in the great state universities that previously existed. So that, in effect, the neglect of the American working class, the neglect of the labor force, is an effect of the pattern of development that has taken place in the post-war period, in which the United States has globalized and in which the United States provides effectively for the growth of the rest of the world economy by lending, by essentially opening up its market and taking loans from the rest of the world, but in which the U.S. essentially consumes and has multinational investment and finance, and in which the economy is producing less and less of its own goods. Just for example, between 2000 and 2007, there was zero increase in terms of hours of employment in the U.S., the worst investment performance in the whole post-war period. So you have lower growth, the worst growth performance. And so what's going on is that you have a strange separation between the leading forces in American capital, again, multinational investors abroad and financiers abroad and at home, who need very little in the way of improvement of the labor force or infrastructure or even to an important degree, middle range technology. So these are people. So you have a situation in which the form of development of American capital has systematically undermined the essentially living standards of the American working class, in part because of the long downturn, the intensification of competition, and the attack on wages and spending, which is something that occurred everywhere across the world economy. But in particular, the form of the long-term problems, which is overcapacity manufacturing and the invasion, essentially, of ever more producing centers in manufacturing on a world scale, that has left that particular form of development has left United States industry located at home ever weaker and able to provide less for American working people. So we're really up against it politically. And when we see the way in which the supposedly democratic Keynesian administrations essentially cutting back on all across the board and hardly fighting the austerity demands of the Republicans, we're reflecting, I think, something very fundamental about what's going on in the United States.
Yeah, I had a question just to fill in the last couple of campaigns, the Democrats have run in part on a kind of reflection or nostalgia for the Clinton years, being apparently in this line of thinking a period of great prosperity. But that doesn't seem to fit with your analysis. Could you just go back and
sure.
take that one on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. There is this tremendous nostalgia for the Clinton period. And there is a superficial reason for it. And the story goes something like this, that going into the Clinton years, there had been, as I said, all of this Keynesian borrowing, meaning the state has effectively spent money much more than it brings in to be able and borrow the rest in order to provide the demand to keep the economy turning over. That Keynesian policy was prevalent throughout the 70s and 80s and into the early 90s in the U.S. and across most of the rest of the capitalist world. Clinton administration comes in and says, okay, we're going to get the state. The state is, parasitic on the rest of the economy, and in particular, all this borrowing is crowding out investment in the private sector, so we have to go ahead and make these cuts to balance the budget, to bring the economy into balance and new dynamism. Well, what happened was, as I said, is that they did move to balance the budget, and they did the same in Europe at the same time. But what the result was initially, in response to those cuts, a slowdown in the economy on a world scale, the worst period of growth in the post-war period between 1990 and 1995. That was the slowest period of growth since the end of the 40s. What then of this idea that the Clinton administration had made for such an incredibly dynamic economy, the golden age? Well, the truth of that comes primarily from the fact that by the last years of the Clinton administration, roughly from about 1997, 98, 99, 2000, those years are years in which you have this great stock market expansion, this great stock market run-up, which is providing the key to what was really quite a bit of growth. That is, stock market, particularly in high tech, rose record amounts. There was record borrowing against by those firms who had high stock prices and therefore looked like they were doing very well, looked like they were, really worthy of huge loans. And the banks lent money to the corporations, who then made big investments in expansion and big investments in labor. And so there was big growth of employment. The last years of the Clinton administration saw for the first time in a long, long time significant growth in real wages. So that looks like this is the golden age, with one notable qualification. This is a period also in which profitability is going down ever further, because you are getting investment and employment and output without the essentially the economy's capacity to justify it. All that's justifying it is the stock market run-up, the stock market bubble. So when the bubble bursts in 2000, people remember the big stock market bust at that time, immediately you can see that the growth of the Clinton administration was dependent on the bubble, because as soon as the stock market falls, then you have the move directly into the most sharp period of fallback of the economy in decades. And it was expected at the time that there'd be a deep recession. It was saved, it was prevented by a new bubble, a new housing bubble. But the point was that by this time, the economy had become, you know, totally dependent on injections of demand nurtured by the state. First, though, that demand had been in the form of state borrowing directly, but then it took the form of the state encouraging asset price bubbles that allowed for, first, huge growth of demand of investment. The bubble bursts, and so investment stops, and you have worse overcapacity. And then 2007, the economy is so weak that it's dependent entirely on working people's consumption. So consumption drives that expansion, but that expansion depends entirely on borrowing that depends on rising housing prices. Everybody was involved in it. Between 2000 and 2007, prices went up. Everybody borrowed money against their houses, so-called ATMs, that their houses became, and they consumed to drive the economy. But when the housing bubble burst, there was nothing left to drive the economy, and we fell into the recession that we're, you know, we've been facing ever since, really, and the greatest collapse of the economy since the 30s.
I know economics is not any kind of a crystal ball, but maybe I could just ask you a question. Now, it seems to me we have a situation where we have what you've described as a weak working class, few popular movements. And I'm not sure if this is what you're saying. On the one hand, you're saying we have a long downturn, but other people might say that capitalism has never been stronger on a world scale in South Asia and East Asia, and Eastern Europe, South America. Could you comment on
sure.
those things and yep. maybe that relationship? And is the downturn going to get longer? I know
right.
these are big problematics.
Okay, but I'll tell you what follows from my own take on it, and people can see if this turns out to be the way things unfold. I think in part they have already unfolded in this way. So what I was trying to argue was that on the world economy, particularly the U.S. core, has been dependent in order to keep turning over in the face of global problems of overcapacity and too much manufacturing entry into the world market. It has been able to continue on the basis of one after another wave of borrowing that provides the demand to keep the economy turning over. This, in its last phases, in the 90s and 2000s, this demand depended on asset price run-ups and the borrowing that took place against first stocks and then houses. And then when those bubbles burst, the U.S. economy went into deep crisis, as we know, which we haven't left. We have unemployment non-employment, the highest levels since the Great Depression, et cetera. Wages have been cut back hugely and continue to be. There is, at the state and national level, ever more austerity. So the U.S., I think people... for the moment, realize the U.S. has been and is still in faces deep economic problems. I'll come back to whether it's starting to solve them in a minute, which some people are saying it is, but I'll come back to that. Now, what about the rest of the economy? Because remember, we're talking about, on the one hand, the U.S., but the flip side of the way in which the U.S. grew was to provide a market for the rest of the world, and particularly Asia, and moreover to get loans from Asia to keep interest rates down, as the Federal Reserve also helped doing this, keep interest rates down, so there could be what? Not only the U.S. market, but the amplification of the U.S. market by American borrowing. And that's what's driven, but the world economy is provided the market for record exports from China and the rest of East Asia, particularly China, of course. And China grew in this most spectacular way as the flip side of the growth of debt in the United States and the weakening of manufacturing in the United States. But in a sense, this form of development was self-undermining because the degree to which it occurred required American borrowing, but no American output to pay back the borrowing. So that China, you know, invaded the American market, and this is simplifying, but it's the case, and depended, therefore, on borrowing by the American economy when the American economy was getting weaker and weaker. So when you get the final housing bust, the demand that had been driving the Chinese economy, particularly American consumer borrowing, ends, and we go into recession. And this, in my opinion, will put and has put an end to that whole long period, that whole long form of development based on borrowing, and particularly American borrowing. And what I think you're seeing is major slowdown of the Chinese economy, which is getting more threatening, and in which the Chinese economy, too, has showed itself too dependent on bubbles, particularly housing bubbles and land bubbles, and it remains to be seen whether the Chinese economy, deprived of the main driving force, which is the American market and exports to the American market, exports to American imports, can continue as it has before. And I would say, I would say in a nutshell, it cannot. It really faces the need for a complete transformation of its pattern of development. Next, the rest of the third world, particularly places like Brazil and other raw material or semi-finished goods producers, were essentially sending money to China. I mean, not money, I'm sorry, sending goods to China and enjoying a boom on the basis of Chinese demand for raw materials, semi-finished goods that they'd work up and then send to the core, Europe and the United States. But since Europe and the core and the United States are in deep trouble, the Chinese workshop of the world is in deep trouble, and therefore the demand in Asia is, from Asia to the rest of the third world is in trouble. So the essentially the locomotive of the world economy looked like it was China, but it was really the growth of borrowing in the United States, and that locomotive has lost its main source of steam. So my prediction is that we're going into a period in which has already started. Chinese growth has dropped off quite a few percentage points and will face even greater problems, leading to further problems in the developing world. This leaves the United States. What can we expect in the United States? I would say what we can expect is that the U.S. capitalists have made a significant recovery, in part based on trillion-dollar bailouts, which have been paid for and continue to be paid for by American citizenry, and then on huge speed-up wage cuts and cuts in employment, so that there's been what looks like a partial recovery, important recovery of profitability. But that recovery of profitability has taken place by huge cuts in demand, by wage demand, employment demand, social service demand, so government demand and household consumer demand. And the result has been that while profits have risen, the investment and employment have not. And it's not surprising, because the way in which profits have improved is by cutting the income of consumers, so no consumption, cutting back on investment, so not much demand from corporations, and cutting back on government spending. So that means that we're facing a situation which it could be the case that we're moving toward an improvement in the economy. Rising profits might indicate that. But I would say that these rising profits are unsustainable, because they have dependent on cuts that bring with them huge reductions in the growth of demand, and so that the ongoing or slow expansion that we've been watching is going to be in significant trouble.
Bob, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there. I want to thank you very much, though, for talking with us this morning. This is Talking About California, our program. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. We've been talking to Professor Robert Brenner from UCLA. Bob is the author of many important books, including quickly The Boom and the Bubble, U.S. and the World Economy, of Economics of Global Turbulence, and also of What's Good for Goldman Sachs is Good for America. So, Bob, good morning, and thanks very much.
Thank you, Cal. Take care.
And listeners, I want to say that for a while we're going to be taking a break with this program. We'll be back as soon as we regroup, I hope. But in the meantime, I would like to thank very much the staff here at KZYX, in particular Mary and John and Rich and David. I'd like to thank them for their support and encouragement, and I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in and listening. So good morning.